Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, whether you're listening to this whilst jogging around the park or just dozing on the sofa, you are burning fuel in your body via the extraordinary process of metabolism. Now, it is fantastically complex, but here's my clunky attempt at simplifying it. So, your body uses oxygen to transform the chemical energy in food and drink into energy that we can use for all of our bodily processes. There you go, that's my bash at it. But now, it's relatively common to hear the phrase, I'm putting on weight because my metabolism is so slow, or conversely, I can eat what I like because I have a fast metabolism. Now, most of us only have a vague idea of what our metabolism is. So, does it really matter what speed it is? And importantly, can our lifestyles affect it? In this episode, we're going to dig into the detail of what the metabolism is, how the foods we eat can affect it, and what we can all do to support its proper function. And with me to discuss this are two wonderful guests. First of all, Professor Alexandra Johnson is a friend of the podcast. She's a nutrition scientist at the University of Aberdeen's Rowett Institute of Nutrition and Health. Hello there, Alex.
Morning, Stefan. Nice to speak with you again.
Yes, fantastic to have you back. And Professor Dylan Thompson is Professor of Human Physiology in the Department for Health at the University of Bath. And he's also co-director of the Centre for Nutrition, Exercise and Metabolism. Hello there, Dylan.
Hi, very nice to meet you, Stefan.
Fantastic to have you with us. Okay, let's just start with the very basics beyond my embarrassingly simplistic explanation. Alexandra, what is the metabolism? Or what is metabolism?
So you actually gave a really good analogy in your introduction there by referring to the way that the body burns fuel. So when I'm using analogies, then I use something similar to think of the human body as an engine. And it's just to refer that engine is continually utilising energy even at rest. So at rest, it's the minimum amount of energy that your body requires to maintain basic physiological functions, because, of course, your organs are still working, you're still breathing, and all those metabolic processes require energy even when you're asleep.
And is it true that the brain uses as much energy when you're asleep as when you're actually thinking or doing anything complex? I mean, because there are so many different parts of the body that are kind of functioning, even though we're not really doing anything. Is that true, Alex?
Yeah, so the brain can think of as one of the most important organs in the body, and it actually prefers to use glucose as a fuel. So that glucose can come from food, or if you don't have sufficient food coming in as a fuel, then it will start mobilising body stores. And that's something that I think we're going to touch on a little bit more later on.
And another phrase that crops up quite a lot is basal metabolic rate. What's the link between body size and basic metabolic rate, or BMR?
So that's a really good question. So there's a really good relationship between body, I'm going to use the proper term, body mass, or what you might call body weight, and resting metabolic rate. And if any of us use the sort of smartphones, you know, apps, you can use them to estimate your resting metabolic rate, so your energy requirements at rest. And generally speaking, you need to know gender, weight, height, and age, and you can estimate from there. So, but actually, you know, we have techniques in the lab that can actually measure resting metabolic rate using what's called a ventilated hood system. So that tells us that what we're measuring is breathing, the amount of carbon dioxide produced and the amount of oxygen consumed. And coming back to your point there, it's not just body mass that's important, actually body composition is important. So we touched on that the brain is one of the important organs. It's not just the brain, but we've got our liver, our kidneys, our heart, but also muscle mass. So muscle is also really important because it's metabolically active and requires fuel. So the higher amount of muscle mass you have, then you tend to have a higher metabolic rate. The same cannot be said for fat mass. Fat is a store, an energy store in the body. It doesn't have that metabolic turnover that we see in muscle mass. So it's really important then what the composition of your mass is. And if I can take a minute to use an analogy, if I've got some twins in front of me, both are 100 kilos, and one twin is a bodybuilder with maybe 6% body fat and the other is not, with 26% body fat. Now they're both the same mass, say 100 kilos, but the bodybuilder will have a higher resting metabolic rate because he has a greater proportion of muscle mass compared to his twin brother who's got more fat mass. I hope that gives an analogy about how I explain it to students.
That makes a huge amount of sense. Yeah, it's a great simplification of something that I think is probably unbelievably complex. So, Dylan, I guess the big question really is, you know, people talk a lot about, you know, I have a fast metabolism or I've got a slow metabolism and therefore X. Can anything alter someone's basal, should we say resting metabolic rate or basal metabolic rate? What's the best phrase for this?
Well, that's a really good question. And I mean, I think in terms of the precise definition, it really depends on the conditions which have been used to obtain the measurement. So to get a true measurement of basal metabolic rate requires measurements to be done in very specific conditions, probably after a day or so of not doing something very demanding the day before. You definitely couldn't have eaten something. You would have to have not had anything to drink, and you would have to be lying down for a very long time to get a true measurement of basal metabolic rate. So
gotcha.
I think many studies in the end actually end up measuring resting metabolic rate. But just coming back to the impact of size, because I think one thing that people often forget about is that actually the relationship isn't completely linear. So if you have an animal, a small animal, like, and we've known about this for decades now, since the work of Samuel Brody in the 1930s and 40s, that metabolic rate is proportional to size, but not in a linear fashion. So just because an animal is 10 times as big doesn't mean that its resting metabolic rate is 10 times as high. It scales by something called 3/4 to the power of body mass. So the increase would only be six or seven times as big for an animal, which is 10 times as big. But, basal metabolic rate or resting metabolic rate is never completely stable. So, I mean, our sleeping resting metabolic rate or sleeping metabolic rate is actually lower than our basal metabolic rate. But people often don't think about that. So, you know, the terms and terminology in terms of basal and so on sometimes leads to a little bit of confusion. But it will be changing all the time over the course of the day. I mean, when you eat, your resting metabolic rate will increase. When you sleep, as I just said, it will be lower than it would be even in basal conditions. And it will then be responding all the time to other changes. So, for example, if you're sick or poorly, your metabolic rate will increase. It can easily increase by 20 to 30% above what would be considered kind of resting conditions. If you're in a cold room, there's something called non-shivering thermogenesis, where your body starts to burn more energy to maintain body temperature. And this happens in different tissues. In particular, there's a specialized form of adipose tissue of your body fat called brown fat, which through a process of non-shivering thermogenesis can lead to an increase in energy expenditure, which will then help to keep you warm. So people have tried to exploit this and to study it by putting people into cold rooms and examining the extent to which you increase your metabolic rate. And again, this can be a really quite sizable increase in resting metabolic rate. I mean, you can be talking potentially hundreds of kilocalories over the course of the day. And that's without shivering. Of course, if you start to add shivering on top of that, your increase in metabolic rate will be even more profound. But there are a whole host of other factors which also influence your, you know, resting metabolic rate or basal metabolic rate. Biological sex seems to be important in predicting or explaining differences in basal metabolic rate. Some of that might be explained by differences in body composition, like Alex was just explaining previously. Differences in hormone concentrations, particular thyroid hormones, certainly can influence basal metabolic rate. But it is important to emphasize that this is actually relatively rare. Probably only, you know, 1 to 2% of people will have hypothyroidism, so low concentrations of thyroid hormones. And so coming back to your earlier point about slow metabolism and fast metabolism, I think there is a lot of confusion in terms of what that actually means. And people often look for hormonal explanations, for example, when actually that's relatively rare. And the biggest, in terms of basal metabolic rate, and we'll come on to some of the other factors which will obviously contribute to energy expenditure more globally, but in terms of basal metabolic rate, you can predict reasonably well a person's resting or basal metabolic rate if you know their size, you know their body composition, and you know their age. And the differences between people, whilst there are differences, I think are relatively small.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned age. Why is age a factor in this? People talk about metabolism slowing as they get older. Is that true? Why does age have any impact?
So, I mean, that's a great question. And as I'm getting older myself, obviously, that becomes more and more interesting and relevant. It's incredibly difficult to study this, of course, in humans at least, because it's hard to follow people up over their entire lives and track those changes over time. But if you look at cross-sectional studies comparing younger people to older people, you do tend to see differences in total energy expenditure, including their basal metabolic rate. And in terms of kind of what might explain that, it could be changes in body composition, as we've already talked about. So people often lose skeletal muscle mass as they age. I think the figure I've often heard is you lose around about 1% muscle per year after the age of 45 or 50 or something like that. So clearly after 10 or 15 years of aging, if you've lost muscle and your body composition has changed, you're going to see a lower basal metabolic rate. But you might also see changes to physical activity. And I know we're going to talk about that in a moment. But in terms of contributions to overall energy expenditure, I think some estimates have shown that age-related decreases in total energy expenditure are partly explained by differences in body composition and partly explained by differences in levels of physical activity.
So the older we get, we do less, and therefore there's sort of compounding issues that change our BMR.
Yeah, and so whether the doing less is one of the things which changes your body composition or whether it's happening independently, I think is an area of active research.
Yeah. Okay. So, Alex, we've heard about the differences in activity and age and sex. Now, are there any foods or drinks that affect metabolism? Because there are claims around, whether direct claims from companies or just people saying that these things change. Some people claim that caffeinated drinks can boost your metabolism, aid weight loss. Any truth in this? Do any of these things actually work?
So first of all, the process of actually eating will actually increase metabolism. So there's something called the thermic effect of food, or TEF, if we use another acronym. So, and that is a naturally occurring process after eating. So we do know that there are different foods have different impact on TEF. And we know that, for example, high protein meals have a higher TEF effect. So we're talking around about, because it's quite tricky to measure, it's around about 10% of the calories that you've ingested will be involved in TEF. And that's the energy involved in the digestion absorption of that food. Yeah. So if you're trying to lose weight, of course, you need to think about it in the context of energy balance. So we're thinking here that you're trying to restrict calories that you're taking in and maximising calories expended in order to be in a negative energy balance to lose weight. So that really goes hand in hand, that high protein diets are satiating for many people. That helps with not feeling hungry, and that can help control energy intake, but also has the added bonus of increased energy metabolism associated with the processing of that food. So as regards other products, yes, there are lots of different claims associated with different beverages. But when we actually look at the amount of energy that we're talking about, when you consume these within normal physiological limits, then it's quite small, actually. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of studies out there on perhaps animal models where they're given a mega dose, but trying to translate that into humans often comes with side effects that you don't want, because when you try and dramatically increase metabolism, then that can be quite harmful.
Yeah. Now, as Dylan mentioned earlier on, that as you're into a colder environment, you can start brown fat burning. So I've just come up with a brand new diet I'm going to make my millions from, called the hypothermia diet. And as long as you can induce shivering, I think we're onto a winner here. I could, just scatter a few sciencey sounding words around that, and Bob's your uncle. I think we're in, quid's in, and all I need is a couple of academics to be able to put their names to it. And I think we're all winners here, the three of us. So
I'm not volunteering. I live in Scotland. I'm cold enough.
I'm the word metabolic is scattered around the diet world a lot. I mean, the keto diet is supposed to cause a metabolic state of ketosis. Some claim causes weight loss. I mean, is this actually something that will make a tangible difference, or Alex, does it just really annoy you that people scatter these terms around?
Well, I think people are looking for this sort of holy grail, and people who are, struggling with overweight and obesity want to find easy ways to try and control appetite and to lose weight. And unfortunately, there are no shortcuts. So when we think about keto diets, so let's explain what they are. First of all, that is a term that's used to describe diets that are very low in carbohydrates. So keto is short for ketogenic diet. So they tend to be high protein, high fat, and very low in carbohydrate. And that could be around about, but certainly need to be less than 20 grams a day is the standard figure. That can vary between individuals, but in terms of a standard diet plan, then below 20 grams a day of intake of carbohydrates, then you will invoke a controlled state of producing ketone bodies. So let's not get confused of an uncontrolled sort of diabetic ketoacidosis. Let's stick with the basic physiology that, as I said before, the brain likes glucose as a fuel. If you're not taking in enough glucose in the food, then the body will revert to metabolizing fat as an energy source and produce something called ketone bodies. And those ketone bodies will be used as a fuel for the brain, and that's why it's called a keto diet. And you can buy urine dipsticks and check degree of ketosis under negative energy balance, if you're following this type of diet. Now, I would say, though, that ketogenic diet means that you'll be in a negative energy balance, you will be losing weight, and some people do find that ketone bodies or beta-hydroxybutyrate also have the added benefit of producing anorexia. So for some people, they certainly help curb appetite, so hunger is reduced. So, and that can help if you're trying to stick to a calorie-controlled diet. So,
and just to be clear, anorexia is not the same as anorexia nervosa, is it?
Can
you explain a little bit more?
Yeah, so that's just a term which means loss of appetite. So You can get old age anorexia, which is just the poorer appetite associated with aging. So that's just a term that refers to loss of appetite. So you were asking about metabolism and different weight loss diets, including the keto diet. So when you lose weight, your resting metabolic rate will decline because you have reduced mass. Now, obviously, the amount that will decline will depend on whether you're losing fat mass or muscle mass, which we've touched on. But essentially, I kind of simplify that to think you're becoming a smaller person, therefore metabolic rate will decline. The opposite is true. As you gain weight, metabolic rate will increase.
It's like it's fighting against you all the way through, isn't it? So, Dylan, are there any supplements that alter BMR? The industry for weight loss supplements is enormous, but is there any truth to the claims surrounding these products? Not on the products, because that's often illegal, but certainly the world surrounding them is full of claims. What do you think about those?
Yes, I mean, so this is something that fills me with dismay every time you go online and look at what the internet's telling you will help to change metabolism or increase metabolism or lead to boosting your metabolism or fat burning and all sorts of things. And like you say, the vast majority of these claims are completely unsubstantiated. So I think I'm aware that the European Food Standards Agency recognised caffeine as a known factor to increase resting metabolic rate. And I think that's probably it. After that, there are some, I think there's a little bit of evidence that things like capsaicinoids, which are found in spicy foods, in some studies have been shown to increase resting metabolic rate, but I think the evidence is far from consistent. Yeah. And I mean, after that, I really am not very sure what else there is that can increase basal metabolic rate. Of course, there are other compounds. I mean, there are drugs which are well known to increase resting metabolic rate. But I think I'd turn this question around and say, would you want to? So, I mean, I can see why it's attractive from a conceptual perspective, you know, the idea that whilst you're sitting around, you're burning more energy at rest. But I don't think that's necessarily something which would be considered desirable in the long term. And in fact, a recent study based on UK Biobank data actually found that a higher BMR, a higher basal metabolic rate, was inversely associated with father and mother's attained age. So having a higher basal metabolic rate seemed to be negative in terms of predicting lifespan. Now, you know, these studies are far from perfect, of course, and there's all sorts of caveats to do with interpretation. But I do think conceptually you should be thinking, do I want to just simply boost my basal metabolic rate? Does it come with other consequences which could be negative in the long term, even if it might look attractive at face value?
Yeah. Now, Alex mentioned that exercise will tend to increase your BMR. So it's interesting. What about not exercising? And, you know, in terms of planned exercise and everyday activities like walking and talking and eating, how does physical activity affect it? And is it a simple relationship?
So I think this is another area of massive misunderstanding and confusion. So I think we should probably consider different terms, exercise and physical activity. So exercise is something that people typically choose to do for structured reasons, or perhaps it's competitive sport or you're going to the gym, those kinds of things. Whereas other physical activity is everything else that you do over the course of the day. And this is sometimes referred to as non-exercise activity thermogenesis or NEAT. And so that would include all sorts of miscellaneous things that most people wouldn't think about as physical activity. So even me talking now, I am burning energy through talking, through skeletal muscle contraction. And one of the famous examples I like to refer to is chewing gum. So if you chew gum, you increase your metabolic rate by around about 20%.
I'm adding that to the hypothermia diet. Yeah. There's a list of carrying.
Absolutely,
here.
Yeah. So, I mean, on a serious note, I mean, it increases energy expenditure about the same amount as standing. So you've seen a proliferation of standing desks. You know, I can imagine you attempting to sell chewing gum to occupational health teams and having
I'm
mass chewing at work.
But, just adding standing desk to the list there. Yeah, but, okay.
So I think these small, low-level physical activities, I mean, fidgeting can increase metabolic rate by 20 to 40%. I mean, ambling around the shops, window shopping, doubles your metabolic rate. More structured or purposeful walking, it might triple or quadruple your resting metabolic rate.
Yeah.
It can increase doing very demanding activities, of course, you know, up to 20-fold. So, I mean, when we're talking about relatively small differences in basal metabolic rate and the effect of interventions which might change basal metabolic rate, in physical activity, you have something which can increase metabolic rate by, you know, 5, 10, 15-fold really quite easily. But you need to remember that this is not exercise. It's not structured exercise. Yeah. If you go to the gym 3 times a week, I mean, our studies have done this. We've trained people, you know, over a period of 6 months, and they're going to the gym 4 times a week, 4 hours a week at a high intensity. At that time, the exercise energy expenditure might only be 10% of total energy expenditure. But all the other physical activity that the people were doing before they even started the intervention could easily be 30, 40, up to 50% of total energy expenditure. It could be as big as basal metabolic rate.
And would a hyperactivity disorder affect your BMR?
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if it would affect BMR, but it would certainly affect your non-exercise activity.
Gotcha. Yes, absolutely.
Your NEAT. So, I mean, and I think one of the most fascinating studies I've seen in this regard was, it was done a long time ago in the 1980s, where they put people into a whole body calorimeter, a chamber, and they had people sitting in a chamber. There's nothing to do. There was, you know, they could watch a bit of TV, they could read a book or something like that. Really, really quite, you know, restricted set of activities. Mm. And in that group of people put into the chamber, some people burned 100 kilocalories a day through non-exercise activity thermogenesis. Other people burned 800 kilocalories a day through non-exercise activity thermogenesis, yeah, in the same environment with nothing else to do. Enormous variation in NEAT in the same environment. And that's almost certainly through things like fidgeting, people constantly getting up, you know, never really sitting down, or just jiggling their leg up and down. I mean, when you're giving, yeah, a lecture at the university, some people on the front rows, legs are going like the clappers for an hour on an end, and other people are sitting there very, very passively. That will have a massive impact on energy expenditure over, yeah, the course of a day.
Yeah. Okay. So, Alex, I mean, the question really is, can we affect this? Can we change these things? You know, so much of everyday life has become automated. Sedentary jobs have increased 83% since 1950, according to the American Heart Association. I mean, are we shifting our own evolution here? Does this have a long-term impact on people's NEAT and BMR? And how might metabolisms differ between a labourer and an office worker? And can you shift that?
So a lot of those effects that Dylan just spoke about, whether you're a fidgety person or not a fidgety person, are probably genetic. So a lot of these traits are probably, we're born with. So, and if you want to change your habits from being, you know, more of a couch potato to that fidgety person, then it needs deliberate actions. Now, we certainly have ample amount of technology that we can use to make us more physically active and get us moving, because we know having a sedentary lifestyle is not good for our health. We know that moving around, even when, you know, we're in a desk environment, you mentioned office workers, that, you know, we can set an alarm and, you know, get up and move around. So we know that sedentary behaviours are not good. So I think these are all, I use the word behaviour deliberately, so we can learn to achieve new behaviours, whether it's eating as a form of behaviour or physical activity as a form of behaviour. But in some cases, it is working against our genetic predisposition.
Yeah. I mean, just to chip in on that, I mean, I think the other thing we could be thinking about would be policy changes and structural changes, environmental changes, which favour NEAT above a low NEAT. So, for example, I mean, when I go to stay in a hotel, I would much prefer, if I could, to take the stairs. Trying to find the stairs in most hotels is an absolute nightmare. They're tucked away somewhere behind the reception desk or something like this, and it's seen as an emergency exit. We've structurally engineered lots of low-level physical activity out of our lives, and I think we could, through policy changes, organisational changes, start to build it back in. So I think there are other things that we could do which wouldn't require just a conscious change on the part of the person, where actually you make it easier to burn energy through physical activity, or at least not to avoid burning energy through low activity.
That's a really interesting idea. And thinking about sort of office workers or sedentary workers' long-term health, you know, what impact can metabolism have on that?
So in terms of total metabolism or basal metabolic rate, I mean, I think we probably need to be thinking of total energy expenditure and the role of physical activity in explaining differences in total energy expenditure. Of course, most studies haven't looked at, you know, total energy expenditure or metabolic rate or aspects of metabolism and tried to understand what impact that has on health, because it's so hard to get these measurements. And instead, what they end up doing is using proxies for behaviours which have an impact on energy expenditure, usually behavioural proxies like measurements of physical activity, whether that's questionnaires or accelerometers or things like that. And if you look at the data, which, you know, come from literally hundreds, probably thousands of epidemiological studies, which have examined the impact of those behaviours, behaviours associated with higher energy expenditures. The impact on health is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, and so if you were to compare a sedentary office worker with somebody who has much higher levels of physical activity, either through their work or through what they do in and around their work, you would see over time a reduction in most chronic diseases of the order of around about 50%. Your likelihood of developing cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, some of the common forms of cancer, like breast cancer and bowel cancer. And so the evidence, I think, in terms of the role of physical activity as a big component of total energy expenditure for health outcomes is phenomenally strong.
So it's not just about calories and body mass, it's about impacts beyond that.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I mean, I think in terms of, you know, physical activity, it is contributing to energy and energy expended, of course. Whether the effects of the behaviour are directly due to the effects of burning energy or whether they are secondary to other changes that happen in the process of burning energy, I think that's an area of active research. I think probably both apply, probably differently to different degrees in terms of specific conditions and outcomes.
Yeah. So, Alex, my next question was phrased in the context of improving your metabolism. Now, can you? I mean, is that concept itself missing the point? That can you improve your metabolism? Is it just a thing that your body is the sum of what your body does, or is it something that you ought to approach as something dynamic that you could change?
So I think you definitely want to maintain your metabolism, particularly as we've touched on ageing in our discussion, that we know in the UK we have an ageing population. So there are more people over the age of 60 than there are under 18. And we know that that is set to increase over the next 30 years. So, and Dylan gave a really nice commentary on the role of physical activity. So that physical activity is so incredibly important to maintain your muscle mass, because you want to maintain your muscle mass and not lose muscle mass as you age, because low muscle mass as you age is associated with frailty and loss of strength. So you want to maintain muscle mass from a functional point of view in order to maintain that ability to live independently, but also muscle mass is associated with better insulin resistance. And of course, to touch on another area, I think it's equally important that being physically active and maintaining muscle mass is also has positive effects on mental health. So
yeah.
So the message, I think, can be, you know, keep active, include the load-bearing activities that promote muscle protein synthesis to maintain your muscle mass, and try and use techniques to defer that decline associated with aging.
So, basically, physical activity is that's what we're really saying is the best way to help your metabolism. Would you both agree with that?
Yeah, the weight bearing activities is what is going to promote the muscle mass retention. So maybe Dylan wants to talk a bit more about that. It's not so walking in itself is a weight bearing activity, but I would be saying, you know, try and think about using, you know, hand weights and for upper body as well.
Yeah, I mean, so very happy to make a comment on that. So, I mean, I think as we talked about earlier on, body composition is crucially important. Maintenance of skeletal muscle mass as you get older is crucially important to maintaining independence and quality of life. And loading the muscles in any way will promote the accumulation of skeletal muscle. It's dynamically being turned over constantly. And if you load the muscle using some kind of resistance type training, you will get a bigger effect. And so that will have positive impacts on the energy you expend at rest in terms of basal metabolic rate. It will also directly help maintain function and independence as you get older. I think the other thing, I mean, without making this too much about physical activity, I think the other role for physical activity is in the context of weight loss. So when people have lost weight, you see a decrease in resting metabolic rate that we've already talked about because they're smaller. But some studies have shown as well that you get this response called adaptive thermogenesis or metabolic adaptation, where your resting metabolic rate is even lower than you would predict based on your size. And this could be to do with body composition changes as a result of the weight loss. And so some people have suggested that actually one of the best ways to help with weight loss maintenance after you've lost weight is through increasing physical activity. And various studies have shown that those groups who lose weight but have high levels of physical activity are more likely to keep the weight off in the longer term. So I think physical activity, really important as you get older, really important in particular if you've lost weight. But I'm passionate about physical activity, so I'd say just physical activity is important, full stop.
I think that you've both been pretty clear on this. So that said, I'd like to take us back to my hypothermia diet, which basically it's just get very cold until you shiver.
Well, you don't need to shiver, just on that point. So it's actually, you can
even
go
better.
Just a few degrees cooler, 16 degrees. Turn the thermostat down to 16 degrees, you'll get a response.
And then various amounts of jiggling, fidgeting, brown fat burning, and lastly, don't get old. That probably puts a cap on that. Okay, so last question to both of you. What do you think is the most interesting or surprising fact about the metabolic process that you've come across in your work? Alex, perhaps you could start.
One of the most interesting points that we should discuss is when you lose weight, where does the fat go? So losing weight is a metabolic process. And I think this is a fun question to do, you know, when you're involved in academia and teaching. You ask students, where does it go? Do you lose it through urine? Do you pee it out? Do you use it in the faeces? And they're sort of think, don't know. But the short answer is we use our metabolic rate to exhale it out. So we breathe it out. So if we think about how we started the conversation about thinking of the body as an engine, that engine is continually running, but the fuels that the engine uses will differ whether we're in a positive or negative energy balance. So in a negative energy balance, your body is utilising the fat and we use our breath, our respiratory exchange ratio in order to lose the fat. So I think sometimes people don't really think that through in terms of how the body functions.
Absolutely. So exhaust gases and exhaust fluids.
Exactly, yeah. So that's one of the fun questions that I like to discuss.
Excellent. Dylan, from you?
Just a quick comment on Alex's. I mean, so I think you can almost see the lungs as the primary excretory organ for weight loss. And I think that's something which people often don't think about. And
Brilliant.
Actually, it's a fascinating concept and gets people thinking more about metabolism, I think, which is great.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of interesting, I mean, I think one of the things, coming back to your point about slow and fast metabolisms and the misunderstanding that people have about metabolic regulation. And I think actually what people need to bear in mind is that the body is fantastically good at regulating energy intake and energy expenditure. And if we just take two extreme examples. So if you have a bigger person with a high level of physical activity, over the course of a year, they could be burning 1.5 million kilocalories a year. A smaller person with a lower level of activity will be burning less than half of that, you know, less than 750,000 kilocalories a year. Now, if we were to gain weight, let's say 1 kilogram over the course of a year, that means that the mismatch between what we've consumed and what we've burned is less than 1%. So the gap, the difference between energy intake and energy expenditure, which is leading to weight gain or weight loss, is actually really, really tiny.
Yes,
just imagine
absolutely.
If the small person started eating like the large person, the calibration, the difference between energy intake and energy expenditure would be enormous. So I always get a little bit disappointed when you see pictures of people engaged in extreme behaviors. You know, you see photos of people lying on a sofa, stuffing themselves with hamburger chips and piles of other things. That's an extreme representation of the truth. In fact, in reality, our bodies are really quite good at matching intake with expenditure, even at dramatically different levels, with somebody with burning huge amounts of energy over the course of a year and somebody else burning a relatively modest amount of energy over the course of the year. So our metabolism's great. And our ability to match energy expenditure to energy intake is also really good. And it's just a slight miscalibration, which leads to differences in weight over time.
Yeah, Okay, well, I'm going to chuck my mini fact in here as well and see if you like it. So metabolic water is basically water that's produced as part of the activity of burning fuel in our cells. So we actually create on a very, very overall level, over 300 milliliters of metabolic water every day that adds to our sort of liquid intake. And so a camel's hump, people think it's filled with water. It's not, it's fat. Now, one of the reasons it's got this fat store is because it can burn that, and obviously you're going to get warm, which is not fun in a desert, but it will also produce a small chunk of water. Am I right enough to point that out, do you think?
Sounds good. I think we need to go and test it out somewhere warm.
Go and squeeze a camel. Okay. Well, that has been absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's interesting. I knew that we would talk about metabolism, and the answer would be, well, it's a bit more complicated than that. But you've been so eloquent and so clear about how it all works that I think we've come out of that with a vast amount of information. So, Alexandra Johnston and Dylan Thompson, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Stefan.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.